Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. I am out at Bucknell University today with Alexander Riley, who's a professor of sociology and anthropology. He's the author of many books, very productive, and I'll list a few of those and then bring it down to our subject. Well, first of all, welcome, Alexander.
Thanks very much for allowing me to do this.
Okay.
It's going to be a lot of fun.
Great. Well, I want to mention a few books here. We have Angel Patriots in the Sky. That is actually a study of Flight 93 and putting the actions of those people in some kind of American context. That was from 2015. The Social Thought of Emil Durkheim from 2014, who has been a particular subject of yours for many years. Godless Intellectuals, The Intellectual Pursuit of the Sacred Reinvented, from 2010, and another work from 2010 that will be really our springboard for today, Impure Play, Sacredness, Transgression, and the Tragic in Popular Culture. So we've talked a lot about high culture here at the conversation over many weeks, perhaps not enough about popular culture. And why don't we really focus on that subject and tell us what led you to this topic of the sacred and the tragic in popular culture. Isn't popular culture just idle entertainment without any sense of the tragic or the sacred in it at all?
Well, that's the provocative way in which I think it's often framed, and in which I think a lot of folks, especially intellectuals and folks who tend to fly at the levels of high culture, tend to think about these matters. Maybe before I specifically start talking about that, I'll give you, since you asked about my interest in the sacred, my sacred per se as a topic. That really starts all the way back with my dissertation and in my first book, which is based on that, which is, this is the Godless Intellectuals title, the third of the titles that you just read there, which also has to do with Emil Durkheim, one of the founders of the discipline of sociology, which is the discipline in which I got my PhD, in which I still teach and work. And I had this idea that occurred to me as I was reading the work of, not only the work of Durkheim, but the work of a lot of the French intellectuals who were around him at the time and who were making contributions, as Durkheim was, to the birth and the growth of the social sciences in France and in the Western world.
And this is turn of the century?
This is turn of the last century, yeah. Durkheim is, his dates are 1858 to 1917. And most of his productive work is going on right around the turn of the century. Really, he becomes a really prestigious figure in French intellectual circles in about 1902. I think he gets a position at one of the most prestigious Paris chairs. And from that point on, basically, he's one of the most important players in French intellectual and political circles. One of the things that seemed clear to me was that in my reading of a lot of the traditional way of making sense of Durkheim's thought and a lot of that French intellectual social scientific thought that surrounded him, the typical way that was made sense of by a lot of the literature before I got started doing my own work was that this was completely secularized thought. Mm-hmm. These were thinkers who had, they had jettisoned all the old religious prejudices of French society prior to the Third Republic.
Was Durkheim an avowed atheist?
Durkheim, well, this is, at a personal level, in terms of biography, the facts there are actually very complicated. Mm-hmm. Durkheim was the son and the grandson of rabbis. He was, his family was were deep practitioners of Judaism and within this rabbinical tradition in his family. He was himself being groomed to take on the father's office at his in his early days. And it was only when he went off to the equivalent in the French system of undergraduate study, university, that he lost his faith at some kind of a formal level. Mm-hmm. We don't have great personal testimony on this as to exactly when this happened, although there's a fair correspondence that still exists between Durkheim and a number of other folks. Some of this stuff was lost through the Vichy period in France, when a lot of the archival stuff, especially stuff that had to do with Jewish intellectuals,
Jewish
like Durkheim.
Scholar, sure.
A lot of that stuff got misplaced, or some of it was deliberately destroyed, etc. But we still have a fair amount of it. Even given that literature, though, I've looked at a fair amount of it, and there's no real good version of what actually happened experientially for Durkheim. We do know that at a certain level, he clearly made the move away from the career plan that he had prior to entering university. He decided to dedicate himself to an academic career, to go into this. There was no discipline of sociology at the time. He was basically inventing it. He studied philosophy as a college student, which was what everybody did in those days.
And I mean, if you're going to become a sociologist, then you study philosophy, you study history,
yeah,
politics.
You're interested in politics. There's really no way, there's not a formal disciplinary space in which you could study that at the time. It was fundamentally, you're studying philosophy, you're studying
religion.
History. You're studying, you're studying religion in the sense that it existed in the French universities of the day, which was basically the...
Comparative religion, maybe?
There was a bit of that emerging, and in fact, some of the folks, not Durkheim himself, but some of the folks who followed in the generation after Durkheim, including some of the younger folks who were involved in his intellectual circle, they were studying with some of these comparative religions scholars in France of the day. There's a huge Indologist, a study of Indian religion in France at the time, named Sylvain Lévy, who was one of the significant mentors of a whole group of the younger scholars who were around Durkheim. And Durkheim and Lévy were roughly contemporaries, and they knew one another and were mutually admired one another's work. Lévy was still a practicing Jew for most of his career. And in fact, there's a little debate on this, but some folks have argued he was a pretty Orthodox Jew. Mm-hmm. And in fact, despite also having a reputation as a more or less secular scientific scholar of religion. Mm-hmm. Huge literature on him. In any event, there was this whole batch of stuff that you studied if you wanted to look into these problems. Durkheim studied all that, but his intention was to create this new social science, this new objective way of looking at how society worked, how politics worked. The central problem that Durkheim was interested in throughout his career was really a problem that he saw underlying those problems, and that was, where does morality in social systems come from? How do we get morals and moral bonds and moral systems in human societies? That's there from the beginning to the end in Durkheim. It's pretty clear, too, that he never completely unhooks himself, if you will, from his religious tradition when he's thinking about those things. And so there's a very deep way in which I think you can read Durkheim, and I try and make this argument in my first book, that Durkheim is really a pretty deeply Judeo-Christian moralist in lots of ways, transformed into a new language. Mm-hmm. He's changed some categories. He's done some other things to tinker with the overall system, but the system still looks a lot like... It would have seemed very familiar to anyone steeped in Judeo-Christian moral traditions had they stumbled on Durkheim without knowing anything about him.
So why do you call the book Godless Intellectuals?
It's Godless Intellectuals with a question mark.
Really,
that's the thing that often drops out in some of the things. I think it's not there, in fact, in the citation of it on our Bucknell webpage. Sometimes it's hard to get the question mark up there.
And you do say the sacred reinvented.
And that's really the central argument of the book, is that's what Durkheim's invention of sociology for him and for the group around him was really a way of doing the same moralizing project that had been done in the Judeo-Christian moral traditions before that in this new language. Mm-hmm. But it still looks, as I say, a lot like that earlier language. He was, in my view, completely misunderstood and misread by a lot of the historians of my discipline who tried to make him a radical secularist. Tried to make him into someone who was the enemy of religion, who thought really, at a certain level, this is clearly demonstrably false. If you just read one of Durkheim's major works, the last one he wrote in his life, which was a work on religion,
is this one of the premises, and perhaps you think one of the fundamental errors of contemporary sociology, in that it does regard sociology precisely as the proper secularization of old ways of understanding the world, that you can't retain a religious understanding, even a cultural religious understanding of society, that those have to be peeled away because they are superstition.
Yeah, it's got all that has to be jettisoned. That's the ideology, I think, that became dominant. And it certainly, by the time I was a graduate student, that was the way I was taught Durkheim. So Durkheim was this adherent to a particular French Third Republic secular worldview. The church was the enemy. All this old traditional cultural toolbox for making sense of things and for running society, essentially, that was outmoded. Now, again, the evidence in Durkheim, as soon as you started to look at the texts, the chief one was, Durkheim wrote four major studies in his lifetime. The last one was a book on religion, where you only have to read the first chapter or so to see that he takes this subject very seriously. He's very clear about the fact that he's not writing a book to denounce religion.
What is the English title of that book?
The English title of this book is it's been translated a couple of different ways, but one of the core ways it's been translated is The Elementary Forms of Religious Life.
Hmm.
And he's attempting basically to go back in a kind of, today we would call this an anthropological study as much as it is a sociological study, because he's looking at, he wants to go back to what he considers to be the earliest forms of human religion, which he thinks are totemistic religions. Mm-hmm. And he looks largely, the data set that he's looking at, if you will, in the book, is largely Australian Aboriginal societies.
Sounds like the Levi-Strauss, The Elementary Forms of Kinship.
Levi-Strauss was hugely influenced by the Durkheimian tradition. In fact, right. Not so much Durkheim himself as Durkheim's nephew, Marcel Mauss, mm-hmm. who was one of these other guys who I mentioned, younger scholar, affiliated with Durkheim, studied with Sylvain Lévy, who also was, I think, a part of this effort that I try to argue for in the book to reinvent some of this old moralizing framework in a social scientific, to put it in a social scientific wrapping, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So The Elementary Forms of Religious Life, Durkheim starts the book by saying every society that we know anything about has religion. Every human society we know anything about has a religion. Already as a sociologist, as a social scientist, that tells you there's something important going on here. This is not an accident.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't an error. It can't simply be an error that we find this everywhere.
Actually, would a sociological description of that talk less about religion and more about the sacred?
Well, this
the
is
the presence of the sacred. There is a place for the sacred in this social structure or this habitat. The sacred is there.
Yeah,
and the point would be to say, how does the sacred function? How does it lead
that's
to
right.
Other seemingly secular practices? And
this is where I got. So I think I had a kind of more or less undeveloped understanding that this thing, the sacred, was important when I got to graduate school. Already as an undergraduate, I think I was thinking about some of these things. Durkheim's book actually gave me that specific term as a way to talk about this, because this is one of the, everybody I think still learns this when they take their graduate course on Durkheim, that the elementary forms, the fundamental way in which Durkheim goes about defining religion is to talk about the sacred. He says defining religion's a difficult business,
mm-hmm.
especially if you're interested in a world comparative perspective here, because there's so many different things that we would want to look at and potentially define under that same term. You've got animistic practices that exist in the earliest hunter-gatherer societies that we have evidence of. You have the universalist world monotheisms that have emerged in the last couple thousand years or so, which are very different from those animistic religions. You've got a whole bunch of stuff in between. You've got Eastern and Western varieties and differences and so forth. Durkheim says the central thing, we can find a common definition. The common definition centers around this thing, the sacred. Every religion, he says, has sacred entities.
And what makes them sacred?
This is the great question. And I think Durkheim has this wonderful attempt to answer this question. He goes, sacred entities, sacred symbols, sacred beings are things that are defined by they're defined by being set apart from the mundane, and they have to be protected from the mundane, and the mundane has to be protected from them.
Huh.
Why are they set apart? They're recognized as having some kind of strange power, some kind of strange efficacy or energy that in fact humans desire to interact with. They desire to try to get those powers, to mobilize those powers in specific ways, to do things that they'd like to do, but they also just want their eternal sources for those human beings to recognize the sources of their own being, the sources of the entire world that's around them. This is one of those things that you see mm-hmm. in even these totemistic Australian Aboriginal groups that Durkheim is studying. He says you don't see, these aren't universalist monotheisms. They're very different from those religions in lots of ways. And yet you still see these sacred entities which are recognized as having these magical powers that are incredibly important, that are incredibly efficacious in terms of their benefits for we human beings, but also for the world. They have to be set apart and they have to be protected. We can't interact with them in any old way. We have to prepare ourselves before we interact with them.
Uh-huh. And you said that in some way the mundane, the ordinary circumstances have to be protected from the sacred. By that you mean you propitiate. Prayer is in part, entreating the sacred force to, you know, help sustain our mundane world.
That's right. All ritual, in Durkheim's view, and this is the Elementary Forms, is really, in a lot of ways, it's fundamentally a book about ritual in human society, in human culture. Ritual exists as the method, as the means by which human beings can move from the profane world that we normally inhabit into contact with the sacred. Mm-hmm. If we don't have ritual to do that, if we don't have ways, for example, of purifying, if we don't have ways of humbling ourselves, if we don't have ways of making sure that various impurities that we might bring with us from the profane world, if we don't have ways of correcting for that when we get into that world, it's almost like there's some kind of an electrical mismatch that will happen, two opposing forces which can cause really catastrophic problems, is their argument. That you really can, if you look at some of the mythologies, for example, and some of the ritualistic practices of some of the Australian Aboriginal groups that he talks about in the book, they literally believe you can cause the destruction of the world if you don't do this ritual right. If you mess this up and come in contact with the particular sacred item here, and if you're not in the right status, you're not in the right position to do, having undergone the right ritualistic purification process, it's dangerous not only to you, but to the whole group and potentially to the whole world.
So there have to be certain individuals who are shaman priests, and there have to be spaces such as the temple that are highly guarded, preserved. I mean the rules have to be followed.
That's right. Very specific rules, very specific delineations of space and of office, as you just noted. Very specific practices that often, one of the ones that I often do in class that both intrigues and potentially nauseates the student that's at a one level, just because of what's involved, is I talk about the ritual practice of an Australian Aboriginal group that Durkheim in the text calls the Wichiti Grub Clan, the Wichiti Grub Totem. The Wichiti Grub is their totemistic figure or emblem. The Wichiti Grub is basically, it's a beetle larva of some variety, rather large. You can find images of it online if you just plug in Wichiti Grub. And this is their totem symbol. What does that mean? It means that they recognize a particular kind of symbolic and mythological relationship of the members of their group to that entity, to that biological organism. But beyond that, the symbol of the grub as well, they'll often, in a lot of these groups, you'll find practices of ritual scarification or tattooing, where people will get the emblem of the totem on their bodies to reinforce the connection to the totem. Mm-hmm. At particular ritualistic periods and in particular ceremonies, there's a requirement that you ingest the Wichiti grub. You grind typically what happens is you grind it up into a paste. Sometimes it's just ingested whole, but often it's also ground up into a paste or into a powder, and then you can ingest it in that way. That's only to be done during the ritual. Mm-hmm. For the rest of the year, it's taboo to eat the Wichiti grub. So you see all these incredibly intricate, interesting, symbolically rich ways in which relationship to the totem is defined in ways that have resonance and salience, not only for the members of the group, but often they also involve neighboring groups as well. So our totem may be in some particular mythological relationship to the totem of a neighboring group. And so we can eat their totem during the rest of the year, and they can eat our totem during the rest of the year. During our ritualistic periods, we're required to eat our own totem as a way of, the argument here is a very directly biological argument, if you will. Eating the totem replenishes the force of the totem inside our bodies. We have to do that in order to keep the energy of the totem alive.
And this is how you handle the sacred. This is what makes it sacred.
It is sacred. It's a potentially dangerous, awe-inspiring, but again, potentially a very efficacious and important power that you have to protect and you have to preserve and you have to recognize its status apart from all this other stuff.
And what happens to the sacred in a progressively secularizing society? Your point is the sacred doesn't go away. It finds other.
Well, that's the question. Maybe I think that's a very. That's an important question that we're facing right now, right? And that has been before us at least for the past few decades, maybe longer than that. Can the sacred go away? Is the sacred something that is an eternal aspect of human societies? The argument is pretty good, certainly all the way up until Durkheim's day, 100 years from us. It's pretty good that up until that point, there had been no human societies that didn't have sacred symbols and mm-hmm. sacred entities and sacred rituals. And again, in Durkheim's broader language, that didn't have religions.
Mm-hmm.
That's really the moment where in the Western world, the moment of Durkheim's life, that's the moment where French society is first starting to seriously come after the religious traditions of the France of the of pre-Durkheim, if you will.
Right.
It starts a little before that. The French Revolution really gets that underway, but it's really under the Third Republic, I think, starting in the last decades of the 1800s, where you get this concerted effort to say the church's power has to be restricted.
Right.
We need secular educational institutions. We need a polity that's more effectively separated from religion, from the church as an institution, but also from religion as a discourse and as a set of symbols.
Well, if we get to the title here, popular culture, can you give us an example of how the sacred has worked its way into the popular culture?
Right. So one of the things very clearly, I think that this is already present in some of Durkheim's work, religion. You know, when you're talking about religion in the anthropological sense, religious practice is it high culture? Is it low culture? It's neither in both. It's culture.
Mm-hmm.
It's what, when you look at the typical totemistic group or the typical animistic religious, this, one of the things I tell students constantly in class when we're talking about these kinds of religions is I say, religion is really the wrong term to use to talk about that. Because that's already a term that, in the modern sense, we talk about religion typically as an institutional space that's separable from polity
mm-hmm,
and from
mm-hmm,
these
mm-hmm.
And in those societies, there's no such separation. It's integrated into all that stuff.
Just sort of right? Ways of life.
It's just a way of life. It's the way that these people make sense of their place in the world. A whole set of symbols and categories that they use for all this stuff. So after I'd waded through this intellectual stuff that was had to do with the Durkheimian tradition and some of these, if you will, high culture intellectual ways of rethinking the sacred, it was easy for me to see that, of course, that sacredness is potentially everywhere. Here's where some biographical stuff really got involved for me. It was clear to me, we've just had a wonderful conversation before we put the recorder on about the value of music. And I think, and one of the things that was that certainly is always there for me when I talk about that is the potential way in which music points towards sacredness. So I had that always as an experiential thing. From the time I was a kid, it was just clear. Some things immediately touched me musically in a way that I didn't have a language for it at the time, but it was like that's getting at a space that is a special space, that's a special state, that's a special kind of experience,
mm-hmm.
that's some rarefied world that is really, it's separate from the mundane world. You can do mm-hmm. it, certainly you can do it, and Durkheim talked about this in the Elementary Forms. He said one of the ways that this ritualistic experience happens in totemistic societies is they all get together, and ritualistic, often playing drums, making music together.
Mm-hmm.
They get themselves revved up into this heightened emotional state. And so not only, they're symbolically pointed to these sacred entities, but also experientially, even biologically, if you will,
mm-hmm.
physiologically, their bodies are getting into this state that they recognize as a different state than everyday. I'm not in that everyday state now where I'm relatively calmed or I can mm-hmm. even be bored. I'm now, every sense is working full tilt.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really excited in all kinds of ways. I'm really alive. I'm really aware. So music, certainly when I was a kid, I played in bands. I went to popular music concerts. And I had versions of that experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have the Durkheimian vocabulary to make sense of it. But I knew you went in there and you did that and you went, huh, that's not every day. That's not mm-hmm. quotidian experience anymore. That's a different space. Nobody had the language, although sometimes you did have a language. Later I discovered people, you know, the Church of John Coltrane and that kind
right.
of way of
that's
talking
right.
about certain...
San Francisco, yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah. Well, look, I remember some conservative commentators, you know, in the 80s or even going back to the 70s, talking about these rock and roll festivals.
Yeah.
As really a kind of pagan religious event, which scared them, right? Because when you go into that state, you sometimes don't know what direction
That's
it can go in, and the abandon that so many people felt at these concerts. Yeah, they're carried out of themselves.
And that's right. And potentially awful things could happen. This is really the film about the Stones' Altamont concert in 1969. Gimme Shelter is a great example of that. You see, again, just to keep going back to Durkheim, he perfectly explains both the... So you watch those films, watch the Woodstock film, watch the Gimme Shelter film, The Isle of Wight is the other great concert film from that period. You'll see both the awe-inspiring, effervescent, I think most of us would look at it and probably at least have the inclination to say positive side of that sacred experience. People clearly emotionally very heightened, getting along with one another, dancing, you know, celebrating a certain kind of abandon. And then in the Stones film, you also see, you know, the Hell's Angels are there.
The Stones
have foolishly hired them to be their security. And they're beating up the hippie kids. They wind up killing somebody in the audience. You see some of the kids in the audience who are just clearly out of their minds.
They're out of their minds.
On drugs. Right. I use that film occasionally in one of my classes, and one of the scenes I always recall to students is there's a scene where a kid has somehow climbed up on a scaffold. He's several stories up, dancing completely without any care in this. I mean, you're just looking at him going, it's just a matter of time until he falls to his death. Just a matter of time. How in the world did he get up there, and who let him get up there, and why is there no one controlling this? The Durkheim,
you know, I had an experience like that when I was about 17. There was one of these mammoth rock concerts in RFK Stadium in Washington, D.C. It was Aerosmith, Leonard Skinner, a band called Nazareth.
I can't remember
the other band, but there was a flagpole in the middle of the one part of the field, and some kid climbed up this flagpole. He must have been 100 feet up.
Yep.
And everyone's just looking. There are no security.
No one even tried to
stop him. And you just think, okay, people are out of their minds.
They're out of control.
They are irrational.
Are
now here's a question. Is the sacred, what is the moral status of the sacred? That's uncertain? It depends?
That's important. That's, again, so back to Durkheim. Sacredness is, he uses these two terms, sacred and profane, as the opposing terms. Often, when we think of profane in the quotidian English usage, we typically tend to think of evil, bad stuff, expletives, all that. That's the profanity.
Yeah.
You know, that's the profane. Durkheim does, by profane, he simply means mundane, quotidian, everyday. Sacredness includes both categories that we would probably call morally good and morally evil categories. You see this in all the great modern religious theologies. For example, Christianity is built right in. God, the saints, etc., are all morally pure, sacred entities. And then you have the devil and Satan and the demons and so forth, who are also sacred entities, not mundane. They're also charged with power. We're fearful of their power. We're intimidated by their power. We want to protect ourselves from their power. And yet there's also sacred entities. So sacredness is, in fact, there's a binariness to sacredness, I should say.
We don't try to stamp out the devil. We don't try to eliminate the devil.
You recognize that it's there. It's a force to be reckoned with. And it's a force to be respected at a certain level,
right.
To be respected is maybe not the right term, but at least to be recognized and to be wary of. You can't just simply ignore it and wish it away. It's there. Durkheim says this is, again, even in these pre-Christian, pre-world monotheistic religious traditions, you see this binariness of sacredness. One of the ways in which one of his students famously talked about it, this is a young anthropological student of his, Robert Hertz, who died tragically very young in the First World War. He wrote a study in which he looked at the practice of burial rites in a series of different groups. These are Melanesian tribal societies. And he looked at how there's often a process by which when a member of the group dies, there's a series of stages, of symbolic stages, if you will, that the deceased person goes through in the vision of the living, in which initially, so as soon as you're dead, basically, as soon as you're recognized as dead, you're now out of the category of mundane. You're now in sacred status. But initially, the sacred status is an impure sacred status. You can potentially infect us and harm us in various ways. We have to protect ourselves from you. We have to remove, so the corpse has to be removed. has to be. There are all sorts of ritual protections that we use and ways. The family of the deceased is often also taboo and separated from the rest of the tribal group because they can also infect the rest of the group during this period.
Hmm.
The deceased person is buried. A certain amount of time is allowed to go by, and so what happens biologically is that the flesh putrefies and rots, and you're left with bone. The bones are pure sacred. By the time there's a transition that's taken place, and then once the corpse has moved from this dangerous, potentially polluting category that it's in early, it's moved into this later status, it now has to be exhumed and ritualistically reburied, and its new status recognized. Now it's pure, and in fact, in some of these groups, the members of the family may be required to ingest some of the pulverized bone of the deceased member of the family because it's now this affirmative, positive energy that we're reinforcing ourselves with the energy of the tribal force when we do this.
Mm-hmm.
So Harris looked at this and said, this is fascinating. Here's sacredness being played out as a process, moving the same entity, if you will, is moving from impure sacred to pure sacred over a period of time in
bio-ritualistic.
But they're both sacred. And they both, again, they're protected by ritual. Both of them together occupy this separate set, this separate experiential world, if you will, that Hertz recognized, as Durkheim recognized, incredibly important for human beings. It's almost as though, they didn't use this language, but I would use this language. It's almost as though, because I think there are some folks who've spoken this language in the scholarly world today, it's almost as though human beings are wired in some way to seek that out.
Mm-hmm.
There's something about that. You know, I've done this at a biographical level with myself. Why is it, my daughter will laugh at me because I tell her, and I've demonstrated it to her, there are certain pieces of music which I can put on and they mechanically make me weep. I can't stop myself from weeping.
Hmm.
When I hear them.
The emotional effect
is that effect.
I have to ask you, can you give me an example?
I can give you an example.
Can you reveal something here?
What's one of the... Well, since we're talking about popular music, I can do that. There are...
You mentioned earlier when we were talking Bach.
Bach is certainly one of those...
He does it.
One of those performers. Yeah, one of those things. There are moments in some of the Beethoven symphonies.
Yeah.
Particular things, particular transitions, where just almost as a matter of course, I start to tear up and I start to recognize that something different is going on here. There's a bunch
and
of this stuff in
you.
The popular space.
It's something inside you.
It's something, I think it's something, well, it's all of that. It's something that I think we're wired to do. Some of it does have to do with cultural training.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where maybe we get to the point of the argument in which we address the possibility that sacredness can disappear. If we no longer have a culture which is training people to recognize that this stuff matters,
mm-hmm.
then the question becomes real. Can sacredness disappear? Maybe mm-hmm. there's still, I mean, I see this in my students who don't have a vocabulary to talk about it. They still seem to have that wiring. Once you start to talk to them a little bit about that, they can go, oh, I see what you're talking about.
Yeah,
but they haven't been trained in the same way, I think, that we were.
Maybe it is inside, that the training isn't an inculcation.
Yeah,
but you're activating something that's already there, and you're cultivating it.
And you're cultivating it. You're providing a ritual space in which it can be played out, in which it can be, you can do it, you know, as a matter of course, on a weekly basis, on a daily basis, whatever, periodically. That's one of the things that Durkheim is clear about. Religions are collective endeavors. There are no individualist religions. So he's a critic already before the fact of the idea of the kind of interior. Bob Bella, the great American sociologist of religion, talked about this as Sheilaism,
mm-hmm.
the privatization, the complete privatization of religious belief, where a lot of, especially younger Americans, they create what they think is their own religion, a hodgepodge of, I like this little piece of Zen Buddhism and that little piece of Catholicism, and I'll stick them all together. And what does my religious practice consist of? Just me thinking things and no ritual.
Durkheim says that's not spiritual.
Durkheim's argument is that that's not a religion. A religion has to be a collective endeavor, and it has to involve periodically celebrated collective ritual.
Mm-hmm.
You have to do this. I certainly remember this as a, you know, growing up in a Christian religious framework where there were physical things you did.
You have to go to church.
You go to a physical space. And then you get down on your knees as a part of doing this. You make certain kinds of physical gestures. You're hearing the same prayers over and over and over to the point that without having to memorize them, you've memorized them. their melodies. This is one of the things that I tell my daughter as well. Some of my fondest pieces of religious culture are hymns and their melodies that come from religious hymns. That's another example. I'll hear the melody and immediately tear up.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even need to hear the lyrics. It doesn't have to be performed in my head. I can do it sometimes. I can play the melody back inside my head.
Well, my response to that, when we think about the secularization of culture and the people who go through life without having that experience, that they don't have the opportunity to experience the sacred and to feel the visceral involvement of that, I would think, why would, you know, you're missing something. You're making something very deeply human and powerful and enriching and everything else.
And religion, certainly, as Durkheim argues, religion was the first place in which we did that, the first cultural space, if you will, in which we did that. That's meaningful, that it originated there. Sacredness then escapes from the realm of religion to some degree. So again, that's why I wrote the book on, you can talk about some popular culture forms which look pretty secularized,
mm-hmm.
nonetheless as deeply involved in sacredness and sacrality.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that for most folks, I think, certainly folks of who are not in the younger part of the life trajectory, their real core experience of the sacred was in religious institutional settings. That's still today one of the central places in which we do it, if not mm-hmm. the central place in which we do it. The fact that that's becoming, at least in some parts of the West, that's becoming rarer.
Yeah.
Again, you've got these processes by which Sheilaism and so forth is becoming, more and more people talk about being spiritual, which really means not engaging at all in ritual, not engaging in any collective stuff. In the realms of popular culture and in some other cultural realms where I argue in my book, it was more prevalent in the past than it is today. You're starting to see it winnow as well. Then I think you get into that territory of are we potentially getting into a human world where the possibilities for engaging the sacred are now so far and few and far between that you get folks who just aren't even aware of what they're missing, of what they're not experiencing.
I'm not going to end on that pessimistic note because I want to have you back.
Because
this is obviously a rich subject, and I thank you for talking with us today.
No, thank you. This was a pleasure.